Learning to Forgive Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. She lost loved ones to the war in Colombia, and she wanted revenge. Then she heard a former rebel tell his life story.
Yo escuchaba, sentía mucho dolor.
I felt a lot of pain. My heart was racing. I was judging him. And I started thinking, this bastard, this son of a... But what if he's the one who hurt me? But then I thought, what if it wasn't him?
Also, will pipeline activism get more Native Americans out to vote on Tuesday?
People are excited, and I've never seen Indian country more focused on something. It's really brought people together in an amazing way. How that translates at the ballot box, I think, is a real open question.
Plus, what the world was like the last time the Cubs won a World Series. That's all today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Glad to have you here today. 1908, that was 108 years ago, for Chicago and their beloved Cubs, both numbers can now be filed under history. But we're not forgetting. Later in the show, we'll hear what was happening in the world the last time the Cubs won the World Series. First, though, the ongoing protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline Project. One big reason members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe are against the pipeline, they say it threatens their water supply and could create a new Flint, Michigan. That's why activists at the protest site call themselves water protectors. Authorities in North Dakota have responded by making mass arrests and using pepper spray, riot gear, and army tanks to stop the activists. That response is drawing scrutiny from the United Nations now. Victoria Tauli Corpuz is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Well, what concerns me most is really the inhuman treatment against the water protectors. I think that they have the right to assembly and right to express, you know, their own views. The action taken by the police is unwarranted. You know, it's something that I think should not be done because these are their legitimate rights. Basic human rights to assemble and to express their views. And if these are done in a non-violent way, then that the kind of reaction that comes from the officials is really not right from my point of view.
So I'm curious, when you travel to situations around the globe with indigenous people, I mean, how do these crises compare to what's going on in North Dakota right now?
I think the situation in many of the countries, especially in the developing world, is even worse because people are getting killed, criminal charges are filed against them, and they stay in jail for many, many years. So the situation in other countries are even much worse, you know. So I'm glad that at least the situation in Dakota is not that violent where they are killing or shooting people with real guns, you know, but still they are not supposed to be shooting them with rubber bullets.
There are indigenous supporters from as far away as Australia and the Philippines, where you're from. They're showing solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota. Why do you think this protest is reverberating so loudly internationally?
Because this is a very common experience of indigenous peoples all over the world, where the racism and discrimination is really something that they experience on a day-to-day basis. And this includes imposing so-called development projects on their territories without asking their consent or consulting them even. And I think that's a very common experience which indigenous peoples feel. And in the end, they are the ones who will suffer the environmental pollution, you know, the displacement from the lands, etc. And nothing is being done about these kinds of injustices. So I think there's a very strong outrage against the injustice, you know, the kind of discriminatory and racist treatment against indigenous peoples. And many indigenous peoples all over the world identify with this experience because it resonates strongly with their experiences.
Mm. What do you really hope your visit will accomplish?
My visit will always allow me to have discussions with these other actors, state authorities, federal authorities, as well as the private sector. So I'm confident that if the visit will happen, I will be able to have that kind of dialogue with them as well.
Yeah, but what do you think your visit will actually do for people who want their water protected?
Well, I hope that their issues will be heeded, that the project will not continue. It will not continue in their own territories. But there will also be a rethinking of whether this is the right path to take.
You really think that's possible?
I would hope so, but I'm an optimist. I would push strongly for those kinds of to support the demands of indigenous peoples, and I hope that it will be possible for this to happen.
Victoria Tali Corpuz is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Thanks very much for being with us, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
Later in the show, the backstory to the standoff in North Dakota and what might happen next. Native Americans have been mobilizing to stop construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline for months. And this being a big election year, the question is, will the Native protests translate into Native votes next Tuesday? The World's Maria Muriel has been trying to find out.
I started thinking about Native voter turnout when I was in Cleveland this summer for the Republican National Convention. Native Americans were angry the RNC was being held there. Native leaders in the city felt disenfranchised, ignored. One man, Philip Yenyo, told me it feels as though Natives are extinct as a people. That made me wonder, now that Native communities are in the spotlight due to mass protests at Standing Rock, are Native Americans rushing out to vote?
Well, it's really an unknown. I mean, people are excited, and I've never seen Indian country more focused on something. It's really brought people together in an amazing way. How that translates at the ballot box, I think, is a real open question.
Mark Trahant is a journalist and professor at the University of North Dakota. He's been reporting on the elections. There are a lot of young Native Americans mobilizing to protest the Dakota pipeline. But Mark says their civic involvement might end there.
A lot of young people aren't seeing this at all in electoral terms when I talk to them. They see it as a separate issue.
Lori Wiocki of the Native American Voters Alliance says the same thing.
We believe that voting is only one tool in the toolbox, that it's not the be-all, end-all, that there's a lot of other strategies that must be implemented if we're really going to build a more healthy and vibrant Native communities.
Lori's talking about strategies like the demonstrations going on right now at Standing Rock. She's based in New Mexico, the state with the third highest percentage of Native voters. But Lori couldn't say with certainty how many of them actually show up to vote.
Oh, my God. So it's very, very tough. I will tell you that data in Indian country is horrible, horrible, horrible.
The National Congress of American Indians is trying to compile more reliable Native voter numbers. Jacqueline Pata is the executive director. And even though she was homesick when I called, she really wanted to talk about this. Because she says, historically, Native American communities had a distrust of the electoral process.
In order to vote in the federal elections, you had to disavow yourself from your tribal citizenship, even so much as having to sign away that you are recognized in yourself as basically a simulated Indian.
And Native Americans couldn't even vote at one point. They weren't U.S. citizens until the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924. And it took even longer for some states to grant Native voting rights. In New Mexico, where Lori Wiocki works, the right to vote was only granted in 1948.
And the reason being, initially, they didn't want Native people voting, especially in local elections, where the races are much closer.
It's hard to track Native voter enrollment and turnout nationwide. But from the interviews I did, it seems like local elections are of higher priority for Native voters. That's where they feel they have a better shot at protecting their land and getting access to services for their communities. It's not clear whether the Standing Rock protests have increased Native voter enrollment. But Mark Trahant, the North Dakota professor, says he definitely hopes they have.
If there's ever an election to get people focused and turned out, it would be now.
Then he told me about a Washington state senator who's Native American, and he was trying to convince Native millennials to show up at the polls.
And they were giving him a hem and a haw about not wanting to vote, and they didn't like either of the candidates. Then he said he let them have it. And he said, get out off your duffs and go vote. He said, even if you don't want to vote for the president, look for all the other people you can vote for and use that power. We've fought too hard to let you waste it.
For the world, I'm Maria Muriel.
We don't know whether Native voters will turn out in big numbers next Tuesday. A point of fact, though, Native Americans got the right to vote in 1924, 5 years after women were allowed to vote. But even as recently as 1957, some states still did not permit Native people to vote. This election has motivated a lot of recent immigrants to cast their first ballots as U.S. citizens. We've been hearing their voices all week here on The World. And before we get to a couple more, let me bring in the world's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell. Hey, Monica.
Hi, Marco.
So you've been talking to a lot of immigrants who will be first-time voters next Tuesday. What is the gist of what you've been hearing from them?
Well, people are really nervous. I mean, if you're an immigrant or a refugee in the United States, you've kind of been in the crosshairs of these really intense debates that have been happening, you know, for well over a year. Almost everybody I talk to is just kind of has this fatigue of kind of wading through this incredibly tough rhetoric when it comes to immigrants and refugees. So they, you know, a lot of people feel under attack.
So tell us about one of the first-time voters you met and whom we'll be hearing more from in a few minutes.
Sure. I talked to a woman. Her name is Rekha Koirala. She's from Bhutan. She was raised in a refugee camp in Nepal, lived for years in Nepal there. And now she lives in Portland, Oregon. So she said that she belongs to three countries, Bhutan, Nepal, and now the United States. And she reflects that nervousness that a lot of immigrants and refugees that I talk to feel going into next week's election.
I am really nervous, and I will be continuously nervous until November 9th. If a Republican wins, if Donald Trump wins, we immigrants and refugees will be horrified with the news.
So, Rekha, this is a woman who spent time in a refugee camp. Does she feel like people around her in Portland kind of understand the conditions she came from?
I think she does feel that way kind of increasingly. I mean, there's a silver lining when it comes to a lot of this very negative talk and rhetoric that we've heard about immigrants and refugees during this long campaign is that a lot of people have also been able to share their stories. And I think that there's been a process where you have a lot of immigrants come out and say, you know, this is my life, this is my story. And not only does she feel like compelled to share her own story, she's hyper-informed about this election and really studying all of the local initiatives because she feels like a representative for her community.
We're also going to hear from a woman from China in a moment. Tell us about her, Monica.
I spoke with a woman. Her name is Lina Lin. She's from mainland China, southern China. She came to Oakland, California a few years ago. And she was also interesting because it's her first political vote, her first vote ever. She never voted in China. Voting always felt like something the elites did in China. But now she's saying that this is something that she can do here in the United States.
If I can be a citizen, I can vote, and then I also can inspire them to vote. So that's why I think this is very meaningful for me, and also I can impact them to vote.
Monica, with both Lina Lin and with Rekha, I mean, we're not surprised that a lot of recent immigrants are voting for Clinton. Are they also voting against Trump?
I think it's a little bit of both, and it's hard to generalize because, of course, there are also immigrants and refugees voting for Trump. But most of the people that I've talked to are voting against Trump, that they're fearful of his rhetoric. At the same time, there's some disappointment that I've sensed among many people that I've talked to that this election has become so polarizing and ugly at times that they kind of feel a little disappointed. A couple of people were a bit wistful about, you know, 2008 voting for Obama and like the excitement about that campaign, you know, however you thought about it. But that seemed to be such a positive thing. There's some idea that, you know, this is like the type of election that might have happened in the countries that they've left, that it's not the type of election that they expected in the United States.
The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Great to speak with you, Monica. Thanks.
Thanks, Marco.
The Cubs win the World Series and other headlines from 1908. That's coming up here on The World. Regardless of what you may think about the Mideast, to be there is to find yourself in centuries of history. Take the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. It marks a spot where Christian tradition says Jesus was crucified, buried, and resurrected. And now it's undergoing a restoration. For centuries, no one's been able to lay eyes on the hidden layers of the tomb. But reporter Daniel Estrin just took a peek.
In the center of the church is a structure called the Edicule. According to tradition, it houses the cave where Jesus was entombed. For centuries, it's been covered in marble. But now, experts are peeling away the marble to see what's really underneath. Kristen Romy is part of a National Geographic team documenting the restoration. She says a diverse cast of characters gathered to see what the experts would find.
It was really remarkable when you first got here because there was this wild group of priests and construction workers and police, and it was just a really fascinating group of people, and everybody just had this incredible sense of anticipation.
National Geographic archaeologist Frederick Hebert took me inside to see what was exposed.
We're walking into the Holy Edicule, which is the shrine to the tomb of Jesus Christ.
As we stood at the entrance, a clergyman approached the shrine and shook incense. Most of the daily church rituals continued as usual while the restoration work went on. We tiptoed around a pile of work tools and latex gloves and a yellow hard hat and took a peek into the shrine's innermost room. It's covered wall-to-wall in marble, and a large creamy marble slab, likely from the year 1555, was slid partially open, like the lid of a sarcophagus.
Yesterday they had pulled the marble off to see what was underneath. Underneath that there was a whole bunch of debris, and now they've cleaned off the debris moments ago.
And with the debris removed, they found another marble slab, a gray one, maybe from the 12th century.
It's partially broken off, so you can see other debris underneath it, but I don't believe that is the original rock. We still have more to go.
The archaeologist says ground-penetrating radar tests actually found cave walls standing 6 feet high behind the walls of this shrine. The restoration team has cut a hole into one of the marble walls, so for the first time, pilgrims will see the actual limestone wall of what's revered as Jesus' tomb.
Over there to the left is the window we opened to the marble slab. The holy rock is visible.
Antonia Moropoulou is from Athens. She's overseeing the Greek experts conducting the work here. They're stabilizing the old Edicule shrine because it's at risk of collapse. She said she and the work crews were overcome with emotion when they exposed the rock.
Of course, everybody could feel the energy in this place, an energy coming from the holy rock, from the tomb of Christ, and an energy from the prayers and the hope that it is inspiring in the world around it.
It's a miracle the restoration project is taking place at all. Six Christian denominations share custody of this holiest of Christian spots. There are turf battles, and it's nearly impossible to reach a consensus on renovations. Israeli police briefly closed the building last year because it was concluded to be unsafe, and that is what got the Christian communities at the church to jointly approve the restoration. But they granted the restoration experts only 60 hours to work in the inner sanctum of Jesus' tomb, so the tomb could go back to being a place of prayer. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Jerusalem.
If you want to take a peek yourself inside that church in Jerusalem, we have Daniel's pictures up at PRI.org. Now to some relatively more recent history. The party is on in Chicago today and probably for a while longer. And it made us wonder what was happening in the world 108 years ago, the last time the Cubs won it all. Who better to transport us back in time than the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe? So, Chris, what was going on in 1908?
Well, let's set the scene with some music first, shall we, Marco?
Gather every Yankee doodle, it's your bloke, I got the boodle, it's your Mr. Johnny Bullet with the proper candy. Let's
so, like much of life in 1908, the music was terrible. That's just a ragtime tune called The Yankee Prince. Life was nasty, brutish, and short for most Americans. There's incredible poverty, most people even lacking the most basic sanitation. And let's place it in time. The Civil War has ended only 43 years ago, so that's as recently as Vietnam for our generation. And then think what that means in terms of not only the huge number of veterans still wandering around, but also there's at least a million Americans alive in 1908 who are either born or had lived as slaves. Then, you know, the Spanish War was just 10 years ago. Puerto Rico and Hawaii are freshly occupied.
Right.
Cuba is under a second occupation. But then at the same time, the age of the Wild West is only just coming to an end, because 3 weeks after the Cubs won the World Series, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were allegedly gunned down somewhere in Bolivia.
Fascinating stuff. I mean, God, it was so different. I mean, it really, what the world was kind of seething. What was different about the American population back then?
Well, obviously, it was much smaller. There are about 3.5 Americans alive today for every one that was alive in 1908. And it was overwhelmingly non-Hispanic white, 88%. But also, believe it or not, there were far more immigrants in the population at that time, 15% almost. These immigrants were unwelcome by many Americans. They were seen as taking jobs, pushing down wages, bringing crime and terrorism, as well as alien un-American religions, Catholicism and Judaism.
And like 2016, 1908, it was an election year, right?
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt was just completing his second full term, and the Republican, William Howard Taft, was taking on William Jennings Bryan, the Democrat. And to listen to the campaign speeches, Marco, you think the world has been turned upside down. This, we've got some audio here of Republican candidate Taft on the stump in Virginia a couple of months before the World Series discussing workers' rights.
They may well unite, because in union there is strength, and without it, each individual laborer and employee would be helpless.
So it's amazing, you know, hearing a Republican candidate pushing workers to organize. He's in the same speech promoting antitrust legislation, taking on big business, and he's promoting civil rights and education for people of color.
The Republican platform adopted at Chicago explicitly demands justice for all men without regard to race or color.
Incredible. So the Republican Party is courting the African-American vote. Did blacks have the right to vote?
Well, they had been given the right after the Civil War, but it was slowly being eroded, principally by the Democratic Party. So you'd find that fewer and fewer people of color were able to vote.
What about technology? Like, what was the iPhone in 1908?
I think the cutting edge thing there was it's the dawn of the age of flight. Wilbur Wright has just demonstrated the first successful flight in Europe. It was the year of the first fatal air crash in Virginia. It's also the year of the first vacuum cleaner, believe it or not. And of course, Ford's Model T is rolling off the production line just a week before, 2 weeks before the World Series.
If you say it, I believe it. So is this a time you would have liked to have been alive, Chris?
Absolutely not. Like I said at the beginning, it was a nasty, brutish life for most people. You know, we really forget how lucky we are to be alive today in terms of just our health, education, and peace.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, a woman in Colombia goes to a meeting and wonders, are these the men who killed my son?
Uy, sentí que me corría unas cosas frías por el cuerpo.
Oh, I felt something cold running all over my body. I felt these chills. I felt that when I got there, I was going to throw something at them.
Learning to forgive after decades of war. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Lots of us have election day jitters, and not just about which candidate wins. We're worried about whether the election process itself will go smoothly. Now, U.S. intelligence experts are warning that Russian-backed hacking could peak on election day. That's what reporter David Rhodes says he heard from former CIA Director Leon Panetta.
He thinks you could see an overall disruption of the internet, as we saw about 2 weeks ago, where attacks sort of overwhelm the web and slow it down to a crawl. You could have fake evidence of voter fraud. One scenario is you could have a higher number of votes cast, let's say, in a predominantly African-American or Hispanic district than the number of registered voters, and that could all be based on a fake document showing those results. The hope there would be from the Russian side that it would be picked up by the U.S. media or by political parties, and you could have a final giant tranche of sort of documents and emails that have been hacked being released. Some of those could be faked, but on the day of the election or the day before the election, there won't be much time to verify them. That's the kind of hacking that people worry about.
So would you say that Panetta's thinking reflects concerns he has that this might happen, or does he actually have evidence that somehow Russia is planning to mess with the election on Tuesday?
Panetta expects it. He said we should prepare for it. And I spoke to U.S. intelligence and law enforcement officials, and they also think it's very likely. There has been this concerted campaign starting way back in the middle of the summer with the hack of the Democratic National Committee emails. And intelligence officials say they've seen it continue and slowly accelerate. They don't go so far as Panetta, but Panetta says that he thinks it will peak on Election Day.
So what actually is the evidence, though, for both Panetta and the other intelligence officials you spoke with to be thinking this?
Law enforcement and intelligence officials thought it was very clear way back in July when the DNC hacking was first announced that Russia was behind it. But it took until October 7th for the White House to approve a joint statement from the intelligence agencies saying that these hacks are part of a concerted Russian government effort to disrupt the election. In private, they say it's not an effort to change the outcome, that the Russian-backed hackers don't have the control to change the total vote tallies. But what it is an effort to undermine the credibility of the vote. I had one sort of senior law enforcement official say, Vladimir Putin has decided that credible democracy is actually an existential threat to his continued rule in Russia. So in Europe and now the U.S., he's doing everything he can to make our elections look not credible.
Do these officials have evidence that they can't show us?
Yes, and we've also talked to sort of private security firms that were called in by the DNC and other firms that have had these problems to do forensics on the hacks. And both the private security firms and government officials say there's evidence that these are being carried out by hackers in Russia. They could be freelance hackers in Russia, but the U.S. government statement on October 7th said they didn't think this level of sophisticated hacking, the scale of it, could be carried out without approvals from the highest levels of the Russian government.
What about a rush to judgment on this, though, and kind of a groupthink that this is what's happening? Because there have been a lot of U.S. analysts saying, yeah, it looks like Russia, but so far lots of circumstantial evidence, even the DNC hack, but no smoking gun.
Again, our sources, and these are private industry cybersecurity groups and government officials, they say it's very clear. It's the same evidence that was used to indict other countries. There's been a series of indictments. First, it was Chinese military officers, members of the Free Syrian Army, a pro-Syrian government hacking group, Iranian hackers earlier this year. They pushed internally saying, we've done this in three other cases. Why are we not doing it now against Russia? And they pushed for indictments.
Where is this going to leave things on Wednesday morning? Are we about to see an event that will make the recount in Florida pale in comparison?
We could. I mean, I think the biggest casualty of the kind of level of partisan politics we have is the sort of diminishing trust in institutions. They cannot hack the election in terms of changing the outcome of it, but they can play on these deep divisions of the United States, these deep suspicions where, Republicans don't trust Democrats, Democrats don't trust Republicans, and make Americans doubt the winner, whether it's, Donald Trump wins this or Hillary Clinton. They can sow doubt that somehow the system is fixed and the true winner has not become president.
Your article in The Atlantic is titled, Is the CIA Ready for the Age of Cyber War? Eventually, how might the U.S. respond if there is a consensus that next Tuesday there was a Russian hack? What are the options?
There could be a cyber attack, a retaliatory one on the Russians. There could be an indictment of the hackers that have carried this out. As I mentioned, it has been done in earlier cases. There could be new sanctions against Russia. The sense is nothing will happen before the election. The United States is the most vulnerable country in the world to cyber attack because we're so connected. And the feeling is that state-backed hackers are sophisticated enough that they could knock out parts of the power grid, parts of our financial system. And I think the administration doesn't want to provoke anything like that before the election, given the strain our political system is under already.
David Rhodes' article, Is the CIA Ready for the Age of Cyber War?, currently appears in The Atlantic and at Reuters. David, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Among the many ballot measures that Americans will be voting on next Tuesday, there's one that may affect millions of kids. Prop 58 in California would lift the state's ban on bilingual education. Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words, is here. And Patrick, what is the backstory to Prop 58?
Well, Marco, back in 1998, Californians approved the ban. The feeling back then among the majority was that bilingual education essentially meant the kids who didn't speak English would never learn English. They'd just be taught in their native tongue. Even if they did learn English, there was still a widespread suspicion about bilingualism, that speaking two languages held a person back. There was even research that, quote, proved that. But since that first vote 18 years ago, there's been a ton of other research done focusing on the bilingual brain. And so we asked the world's Ari Daniel to take a look at all of that research. And here's an excerpt from the story that he did for The World in Words.
Here's the question. Does being bilingual carry any advantage? And that question is, at least in the U.S., the subject of a heated discussion. It's not a simple pro versus con debate, says Thomas Bach, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Edinburgh.
If we approach a topic as complex as bilingualism, to believe that you can practically give a simple yes and no answer is, for me, quite naive.
Let's pull apart some of that complexity. A good starting place, says Judith Kroll, a psycholinguist at UC Riverside, is to know that in the bilingual brain, both languages are active at all times, even when just one of those languages is being spoken.
Bilinguals develop exquisite control to be able to master and regulate the use of the two languages.
That control allows bilinguals to switch between their languages, select one language while suppressing the other, and focus on what they're communicating in the moment.
The idea is that control isn't necessarily limited to language itself, but may spill over into other domains of cognitive function.
Like ignoring irrelevant information and paying attention to what's useful, or juggling different tasks. Kroll says these abilities can come online as early as 7 months for some babies, though not all. And Thomas Bach says there may be big payoffs for bilinguals much later in life, too.
I was involved in studies showing that people who speak more than one language have slower cognitive aging, have also 4.5 years later onset of dementia, and recover faster after stroke.
And some of these benefits may pertain not just to those who grow up bilingually, but also to those who learn another language as adults. These studies are part of a large body of work published over the last 2 decades that reveal an about-face in how we think about bilingualism in the United States. It used to be viewed as an impediment to learning. Now it's the opposite, where bilingualism is seen as beneficial to some degree, though not by everyone. Recently, Ken Papp, a cognitive psychologist at San Francisco State University, has been critiquing the studies demonstrating bilingual advantage. He argues that the control required to master and deploy two languages doesn't necessarily transfer to other domains. He questions the demographics of the populations being tested. And he says that if researchers don't detect a bilingual advantage in a particular study,
they're likely to just place the results of their study in their file drawer and never attempt to publish it. Likewise, reviewers and editors, their typical reaction is, well, that's pretty boring, and those manuscripts are likely to be rejected.
Initially, Thomas Bach welcomed these criticisms.
Debate is healthy in science. It's necessary.
But Bach says that he and other researchers have responded to Ken Papp with studies that have nipped his complaints in the bud. Still, Papp's persisted in vocalizing and publishing his same doubts. Bach says it's time to move on. So does all this back and forth amount to anything more than academic infighting? This is where we get to the election in California.
Yes, the election. So back in the studio with Patrick Cox from The World in Words, what has changed in California? Is there a chance voters will actually reverse themselves and overturn this ban on bilingual education?
There certainly is a chance because, firstly, there's all of that research that we just heard about that has really changed the way that we think about speaking more than one language. Mm. There have also been changes in the education system, in particular the rise of dual language immersion programs, you know, where you learn in English for part of the day and in a second language for the rest of the day. Those are extremely popular with parents, but there aren't that many of them in California because of the ban. Parents, they have to sign a waiver even to get themselves on the wait list. And finally, there's the demographic change. California is far more multi-ethnic and multilingual than it was in 1998, and that's reflected in the electorate.
Patrick Cox of our World in Words podcast, thank you very much. Fascinating stuff.
You're welcome, Marco.
Earlier on the show, we were talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, and we heard from the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She's looking into possible human rights violations by North Dakota authorities in last week's clashes with Native protesters. The clashes near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation continue, and now even President Obama has weighed in. Reporter Sandy Tolan has this look at how the pipeline standoff developed and where it might be going.
It started last April with two people praying in a teepee for others to come and help fight an oil pipeline that they said would threaten their land and water. And come they did. Climate activists, social justice groups, Black Lives Matter, Native people from around the world, and just down the road. Today there are the flags of nearly 300 tribes planted in a protest camp. People here at the edge of the Standing Rock Reservation say it's the first time the Great Sioux Nation has fought as one since the 1876 Battle of Little Bighorn.
Oh gosh, thousands and thousands of people.
Linda Black Elk is an ethnobotanist and professor at Sitting Bull College at Standing Rock.
There are so many elders who you hear them say over and over, they're just so thankful that they've lived long enough to see this moment in history.
Their collective target, the 570,000-barrel-a-day Dakota Access Pipeline. Here's Candy Mossett of the Indigenous Environmental Network.
It would increase emissions by the equivalent of 29.5 new coal-fired power plants per year.
For Native people here, it's mainly about protecting sacred sites and the water of the Missouri River. Linda Black Elk points out the pipeline is only coming here because residents of the state capital didn't want it near them.
The city council of Bismarck and other people stood up and said, no, we don't want this pipeline to cross the Missouri north of Bismarck. That's going to mess with our water supply. So they decided that putting it just north of the Standing Rock Reservation was okay. And they absolutely expected us to not care. But they were wrong.
That determination led to last week's clash after protesters set up a second encampment directly in the path of the pipeline on lands granted the Sioux Nation in a treaty, but later taken away.
America's built on stolen land!
This brought an angry confrontation with local police, led by Cass County Sheriff Paul Laney.
You have a blockade across a state highway. All right, you have occupied private land. Okay. You're forcing our hand.
We don't want to make arrests.
The next day, hundreds of state and county police and a heavily armed National Guard moved in. They arrested 140 people, releasing clouds of pepper spray and bringing rioting charges. More than 50 protesters were treated for injuries. The arrested had numbers written on their arms. Most were held in cells resembling dog kennels. And the rough treatment continues, as captured in this video posted on Twitter. Yesterday, police responded with more pepper spray and rubber bullets when a group tried to cross a tributary of the Missouri River to prey on lands near the pipeline. But construction on the pipeline continues, and backers say there's no reason to hold it up. Here's North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple speaking at an energy conference last month.
This has already gone through the process. It's done. It's finished. All of the permits have been granted.
The Standing Rock tribe says it was never properly consulted and that the pipeline was fast-tracked. They got a break recently when the Army Corps of Engineers put a hold on the key Missouri River crossing right next to the reservation. And this week, President Obama offered sympathetic comments. In this interview with the online service Now This News,
my view is that there is a way for us to accommodate sacred lands of Native Americans.
The president said he would let the situation play out over the next few weeks.
Right now, the Army Corps is examining whether there are ways to reroute.
With all the money they've spent and all the pipe they've laid, it's not likely Energy Transfer would agree to change the route. But pipeline opponents like Mikasik Hamp Horanek say they'll never back down either.
It's never over, and we're never defeated, and we're never conquered. When our backs are against the river, we'll still be standing there to protect that water and to protect that river.
For The World, Sandy Tolan, near Cannonball, North Dakota.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. How do you learn to forgive after decades of war? That's a real question for millions of people in Colombia. There are even schools there to help with the reconciliation process, supported by both the Colombian and U.S. governments. So what's it like in those classrooms? The World's Jasmine Garst with our Across Women's Lives team went to Colombia and found out.
Honestly, in the beginning, Floralba Montes just wanted revenge.
No, pues algunas me decían, ay, pero usted es capaz de.
Some women would ask me, are you capable of setting off a bomb? And I'd say, yeah, of course I am, because those people who did a lot of bad things, they can't do it again. This has to end.
It's nighttime in the Amazonian city of Florencia, and we're sitting in her dimly lit kitchen. Her face glistens with sweat.
I should mention that Flor Alva is one of the least scary people I've ever met. She is, on a molecular level, a mom. She has a poofy mom haircut, high-waisted mom jeans, and she's super worried about how I'm going to get home later. Which is why what she's saying is so jarring.
It would have been easy, because you're a woman, and they don't think you're capable of too much.
Flor Alva jokes that she hated every faction of the war equally, and she had reason to. First, the paramilitary forces killed her son. 2 years later, her father, a farmer, was killed in a confrontation between the army and the left-wing guerrilla group FARC. She gathered what remained of her family and came here. Over time, she started to get help. She got counseling from the government, and she became friends with the local priest. Then one day he came to her with a proposal that shocked her.
Y me dice, ¿tú quieres dialogar con algunos victimarios?
And he says to me, would you like to talk with former fighters?
Former combatants, like the ones who killed her son and father.
Yo le dije, ay, no, jamás.
No, never. Don't even mention them to me.
It was a program run by the Colombian government to help former enemies and victims tell their stories to each other. The priest insisted, and eventually Flor Alva changed her mind. Kind of.
So one day I say to him, I'm going to go.
Uy, sentí que me corría unas cosas frías por el cuerpo.
Oh, I felt something cold running all over my body. I felt these chills. I felt that when I got there, I was going to throw something at them.
So she actually went to this meeting, not in good faith. And to her dismay, when she got there, everyone was dressed in civilian clothes. She couldn't tell who was who. A young man was telling his story.
Dijo que se lo habían llevado hace más o menos siete, que cuando él tenía como siete años, incluso él no se recordaba bien.
He'd been kidnapped when he was 7 years old. The guerrillas took him, the FARC. And he'd ask them, why am I here? Where are my parents? They taught him to use a weapon. And he said that the worst thing that had ever happened to him was the first time they sent him to kill someone. He can never forget this murder. The man he was sent to kill asked him not to do it. He said, I'm someone's father. And that filled him with rage, because he wasn't with his own family. That rage helped him kill. And I started to realize he was a guerrilla.
He was one of them, the subject of all her revenge fantasies. But it didn't play out the way she'd dreamt it.
Yo escuchaba, sentía mucho dolor.
I felt a lot of pain. My heart was racing. I was judging him. And I started thinking, this bastard, this son of a... But what if he's the one who hurt me? But then I thought, what if it wasn't him?
She couldn't talk. She just walked away. But she was drawn back to those face-to-face meetings. And she started feeling something she found inconvenient. She started feeling sorry for those men.
And I started feeling less rage. I started feeling this pain.
She began to imagine forgiveness. That's something many Colombians still cannot do or want to do. They made that clear a few weeks ago when a slim majority voted against a peace deal between the government and the guerrillas. They thought it was too lenient. They weren't prepared yet to forgive.
50% of Colombians were very angry about this. The 50% of Colombia wanted punishment.
This is Father Rafael Narvaez. He's the founder of the Schools of Forgiveness and Reconciliation. The program brings victims and former combatants together to sit down in the same room and listen to each other and discuss how to forgive.
They express their problems and their feelings, but at the same time, they are able to find their own solutions. But, you know, I think this has been the secret of our work because, you know, we do not teach them how to face a problem, but they themselves, they generate the solutions.
When he opened a school in the city of Florencia, Flor Alva Montes, the mom who used to dream of revenge, was ready to help. There are currently around 10 schools operating around the country. Early in the afternoon, I drive over to visit the one where Flor Alva teaches. It's in a tiny settlement in the mountains. About 20 kids are gathered in a small shack. She passes around balloons. On that balloon, she instructs, I want you to write down your name, the name of people you love, and your best and worst qualities. There are the predictable balloon fart noises and giggles, but the kids take their assignment pretty seriously. The balloons are filled with scribbles,
Flor Alba turns on some music and has them dance around and bounce them in the air. "Those balloons," she yells, "are your lives. Keep them high up. Keep them off the ground. Now give your life to a friend. Trust your friend with your life. Help each other. You have to help each other keep your lives up." It's Kindergarten 101. But after 52 years of war, it's not a bad thing to relearn. As I watch them play, it strikes me that the students are mostly girls. In a way, that makes sense. Colombia's war has affected women very specifically. An estimated 40% of rebel fighters are women. Tens of thousands of widows. Over 1,700 known victims of sexual violence. But where are the boys? Where are the men? Why are women the ones who have to forgive? Sitting with Flor Alba in her kitchen, I have to ask, did you really, honestly forgive them? And she says she has. And then she adds,
"And you know what? I asked for forgiveness, too. Do you know all the things I thought about doing? I wish them dead. And my hope was I could help tear them apart."
It's getting really late, and as it turns out, it's Flor Alba's birthday. I scold her for not telling me this. Her two remaining sons arrive with their wives and her grandchildren. They've brought her a new baseball cap, and she puts it on, beaming. It reads, "Feliz día, Supermamá." Happy birthday, Supermom. For the World, Jasmine Garst, Colombia.
Oh, what a powerful story. That's where we leave you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.